in a world full of straight people. Aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
Start your engines and join me in the new mobile game, RuPaul's Drag Race Superstar. May the best superstar win. Available now.
Matthew,
David,
good day to you.
Good,
in fact, great day
to you. Great day.
You know what? Great day.
Talk about a long time coming with this guest.
I mean, another in our series of how have you not been on this show yet?
Just me sitting by my phone, you know. I don't know what to tell you.
You know what? You know what? It's on us. It's on us. Alonzo Duralde. Hello, Alonzo.
Hello, Dave. Hello, Matt.
How
Alonzo,
are
I guess it took you writing a fantastic book for us to finally have this breakthrough. The book, we should say, is out on May 14th. It is called Hollywood Pride, A Celebration of LGBTQ Plus Representation and Perseverance in Film, written by Alonzo Duralde.
Thank you, sir. Yes, I pretty much wrote it to get on podcasts like this one. So mission accomplished.
Right. You did it. You did it. So we speak on May 13th. How was your Eurovision Saturday?
We watched about the first half, and then Dave was like, you know, I really have other stuff to get caught up on. So he watched a movie and I took a nap. And so I still have to watch the rest of it. Mm. I have to say the first half was not blowing me away. I UK is sending a pro guy in, you know, which I never like. And some of the other, you know, I'll tell you, I'm all about Windows 95, man. That's the kind of energy I want to see in a Eurovision performance.
And it came at just the right time.
Please define Windows 95, man.
It was after a couple really boring ballads, the show needed a shot in the arm. Couldn't agree with you more.
And I can't believe they had to blur the logo. I'm thinking like Microsoft has not been this cool in decades, not since they got Jennifer Aniston and Matthew Perry to describe how Windows 95 works. I think they should be endorsing this guy and underwriting him and letting the logo be unblurred. But what do I know? I'm not the geniuses who have made Microsoft the household word that it is.
Yeah. You know, I would buy the hell out of a blurred Microsoft Windows 95 logo t-shirt, but you can't. They're not available. They have plenty of merch, but that is not one of the things that they offer.
You just spoke it out into the world. Somebody on TeePublic is cranking it out right now.
Okay, great. And I'll be right there and I'll take two. Alonzo, what are you watching lately other than Windows 95?
I like to keep it really sort of cutting edge, and you know, you might not even know about these shows yet, but trust me, you'll get to them. I'm currently rewatching Mad Men and watching The Good Place for the first time, which are both quite thrilling, actually. Mad Men, like, there's just so much to get on multiple viewings, especially because my friend Matt Zoller Seitz wrote this really great book called Mad Men Carousel, which is an episode by episode, you know, guide and breakdown, and not only just about what happens within that episode, but how it factors into the show at large. And so after each episode, I go back and reread the chapter about the thing, and it's like, oh, that's such a good insight. I didn't even catch that, you know. And then Good Place, I don't know why I've been sitting on it for this long, but I'm really enjoying it.
Excellent.
I'm glad you brought it up. I've been sitting on it too. Also, I am due for a Mad Men rewatch. How far into the series are you right now?
Mad Men, we just ended season one. So okay. Peggy is now a junior copywriter, and she's been handed the Clearasil account. It's very exciting.
Okay. Oh, huge.
Oh, also she had a baby.
Sure. I mean, that's less exciting for her, as we know.
For sure. Yeah, no, it's a packed episode.
I am curious. I mean, obviously, I want to talk about the book, and I wonder if, you know, promoting the book has aggravated this in a sense, but what it's like being a, you know, an esteemed film critic, a true film critic, when every gay man considers himself to be a film critic.
Yeah, my joke for years has been that film criticism is like pornography, where it's harder to get paid for it when so many people are willing to do it for free. Yeah, I never think of myself as esteemed, certainly not in my own head. And, you know, this has been an ongoing process of kind of, you know, the democratization of everything, which has its upsides and its downsides. Obviously, like, you know, the death of the media as we know it is not great, not just because of the opportunities being taken away, but sort of, you know, things like fact checking and authoritative voices. You know, on the other hand, I think that, you know, there isn't like a test you take to become a film critic, you know, so I think it's up to the reader or listener or whatever to determine, well, this person seems to know what they're talking about. This person has a depth of knowledge that precedes the cinema of 1980, you know. But sometimes if you are somebody who just wants somebody else who has dug deep into every Star Wars movie and TV show and is going to look at things through the filter of every Star Wars movie and TV show, then, you know, you've got that waiting for you. But I definitely can relate to, did you guys hear the news last week about the Art Directors Guild?
No.
So this is a union that does, like, you know, art directors and set designers and, you know, previz artists and all this stuff. And they have they've had a very successful kind of internship program where you would apply and they would bring people in and sort of give them exposure to the industry. And this year they're like, yeah, we're just not doing it. 75% of our membership is unemployed. So we can't in good conscience, like, you know, bring you into this industry because it's not what it used to be. And so when people ask me, oh, you know, how do I become a film critic? You know, lately I'm like, well, have a really good paying day job and then make this your fun hobby, because, you know, the gigs just dry up more and more every year.
Well, I guess writing a book that's, you know, bound to be a bestseller certainly helps supplement the gigs.
Your mouth to the New York Times is ear.
What's the origin story? What was the sort of initial spark, or, you know, what's the why now of the book?
Well, I'll tell you, the why now is Running Press brought it to me. Running Press does all of the TCM books, and, you know, they bless them, because I'll tell you, getting film books published, as somebody who writes film books, I can tell you, gets harder all the time. But because of the brand of TCM and because of the kind of fervent audience they have developed over the years, you know, they are really good at figuring out, you know, how to get people to buy books, which is a real miracle these days. So they had done, this is kind of unofficially a series, I like to think. They had a book a few years back called Hollywood Black by the great Donald Bogle, which was a history of, you know, Black images in film and storytelling and filmmakers. Then that was followed up a couple years later by Luis Reyes's Viva Hollywood, another great book about Latine Hispanic, you know, presence in Hollywood and in the studio system. And so now this is the LGBTQ version. And they pitched it to me and I was like, yes, I would like to do that. And so it kind of went from there. And what's cool about it is, you know, I did walk into this thinking, I got this. I'm covered. I know the basis here. And then, of course, you know, you sit down and write a book like this. You're like, oh no, I didn't know this, and I didn't know that person, and I had no idea about this other thing. And so it's been, you know, a fascinating process of discovery for me too, and I hope for readers.
Yeah. What was your favorite thing that you learned?
I'd say, like, there were just individuals that popped up along the way that I didn't know about. Like this guy, James Crabe, who, you know, is the cinematographer for movies like Rocky and The Karate Kid. You know, like, one of the things about this book is, like, there are queer films and there are queer filmmakers, and a lot of the best queer films are made by queer filmmakers, but so many queer artists also contributed to the movies that your dad likes. Yeah. And so, you know, Crabe had this great career before his, you know, tragically dying from complications of AIDS in his 50s. But he got his start. There was this kind of loosely affiliated group of, like, gay men in the film industry and drag queens called the Gay Girls Writing Club. And they would get together and make these goofy short films that were kind of parodies of well-known movies. So they had titles like What Really Happened to Baby Jane or A Roman Springs at Mrs. Stone. And they would screen them at, like, parties and in bars or whatever. And, but, you know, that was a much more visible queer presence that the film industry had ever seen before, because usually it was like, you know, discreet parties at, you know, dinner at somebody's house or whatever. Maybe there might be a club where things are happening, but this was very kind of out and in your face and making these very campy short films, which incidentally were all restored a few years ago by the American Genre Film Archive. So if you have Tubi or Canopy, you can watch them. But, you know, but then out of that comes people like James Crabb, who then get, you know, folded into the mainstream industry. And no way does their like obvious or like unhidden queerness impede their career.
Okay. Who's I'm getting Tubi.
Yeah, what I love about the book is you manage to balance this, strike this balance between historical context and fun. It's actually fun, you know, that because it does span so much history, not just Hollywood history, but you put it all into, you know, context and illustrate how, you know, world events shaped the movie industry and the way queer people were treated within it. But I do want to qualify for the dum-dums out there like myself. It is also a surprisingly fun read.
Oh, thank you.
And I think a lot of that is of course just your voice there. And there are a lot of sort of film history things that I have always had just a blurry notion of, like the production code, where I'm like, yeah, I know what that was. But one of them was the pansy craze in the 30s. Can you tell listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. So there were a few nightclubs in LA in the early 30s where there would be drag performers and, you know, drag kings. And it was a very kind of queer atmosphere. And they were among the few places that were still serving booze while prohibition was still the law. So they became very popular and very popular among, like, you know, you would see studio heads and big stars there, you know, to see whatever the floor show was that night. And then eventually the police started raiding them, and that sort of, you know, probably might not have been the first, but it was definitely part of a chain of those kinds of police raids that would plague, you know, queer institutions, you know, through, you know, and beyond, I guess, the Stonewall riots. But yeah, there was this moment in the early 30s, you know, that was referred to as the pansy craze, where everybody was going to these clubs. But the thing about the code, and this is actually another thing that I learned along the way, is that the code didn't just dictate what the movies could and couldn't do, but it sort of applied to everybody's off-screen life as well. So suddenly you had studios pressuring, like, you know, stars who were living together to get married, you know, or gay stars to marry a woman, you know, or lesbian stars to marry a man. You know, women were told not to wear pants in public. You know, Katharine Hepburn famously fought with RKO about this. So it became this thing, not just of like, oh, the movies are going to be wholesome now, but also the image that Hollywood shows of the world, and when, you know, all these kind of like gossip magazine articles or whatever, is going to be this wholesome, cleaned up image to match what we have to do on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, well, speaking of gossipy tidbits, you do satisfy, I think, readers' thirst for some of the more gossipy aspects when it comes to just, like, you know, rumors about queer artists without ever sacrificing your, you know, taste or integrity. And I mean, obviously there's the more established history of like your Rock Hudsons and Tab Hunters, which of course are included too, but I'm talking more about the Marlon Brando, James Dean, you know, the sort of, were they, weren't they's.
Well, I mean, Brando talked about it. Brando said, yeah, I've had sex with men. I'm not ashamed about it. And, you know, you've heard the stories about him and Richard Pryor or whatever. Like, there are some sort of well-known examples. His ashes are currently mixed with those of TV star and comic Wally Cox. You know, let's make of that what we will. Yeah, it is. There's something unique about doing queer history that puts you in a realm of having to deal with gossip, because there aren't birth certificates or land records or something that are going to get you to somebody who is, you know, an LGBTQ plus person. It comes down to, did they write letters? Did they keep a diary? Are there surviving partners, or just, like, you know, the lore of it? And then it becomes a question of, well, what do we trust in the lore? Who do we believe? And so there were a few sources where I was like, I'm not going to rely on this, but I will rely on, say, William Mann's Behind the Silver Screen, because that's a very thoroughly researched book. And he's, I think, a respected film historian. But yeah, gossip does become the vernacular for a book like this, because that's what we're left with. You know, I've had conversations with older film critics who were like, you know, I get it that we need to, you know, talk about, you know, who is part of the community. But I mean, do we have to talk about their sex lives? And I'm like, well, those are the receipts. You know, we can't talk about, like, you, because if you say so-and-so was lesbian or bi or whatever, and then the question is, well, what's your proof? How do you know? And then if you tell them how you know, then it's, oh, I don't want to hear about their sex life. So it's a bit of a catch-22.
You know, my gayest trait is being a lifelong Judy Garland, Wizard of Oz fan. So of course I loved when you wrote about both of those. And I like your approach to the topic and the question of, like, what is it exactly that makes the Wizard of Oz and her queer icons when there's nothing explicitly gay about it? And, you know, there in a way has been explored to death. It's like, is it the chosen family aspect of it? Is it just like Judy Garland's longing in her performance? And I think your take is that it's sort of like, it's all of those things, and maybe it's none of those things. But how do you approach something like that, that it feels like it's already been explored to death?
Yeah, I kind of felt like, you know, because this is aimed at the TCM audience, and I don't think they've really done other books on this topic, I couldn't assume anything could be taken as read, you know.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of people who are approaching this who've maybe never read any kind of queer film scholarship or LGBTQ studies of any kind. So I couldn't not talk about, you know, I couldn't not unpack The Wizard of Oz at least a little bit. You know, but it all kind of comes down to just sort of how we perceive art. You know, there is, you know, the creation itself and what the artist's presumed intent was, but then ultimately it's handed off to the viewer, and the viewer kind of has the last word about what things mean or what they mean to certain people. And I think in the case of The Wizard of Oz, it is such an ongoing fascination, and there is such an ongoing connection that you have to sort of try and connect those dots a little and figure out, what is it exactly that we're responding to in this way?
What is it that you are responding to?
I'll tell you, I'm the worst person to ask, because I'm not a big fan of The Wizard of Oz.
Ooh,
I know, I'm a Matt, bad,
Matt,
I'm a terrible
just guy.
I am out. Okay.
I'm more of a Star is Born guy myself. That for me is peak Judy. You know,
that take I do appreciate. Sorry, okay. Continue.
Sure, no worries. But no, but I mean, as a text, there's no denying that. I mean, and the thing is, it's not even just queer people. Like, there was a documentary last year called Lynch Oz, that's just about how The Wizard of Oz keeps popping up in the films of David Lynch over and over and over again. And, you know, there's a famous saying that pretty much every film since The Wizard of Oz references The Wizard of Oz. So, you know, it is the Hamlet. I don't know. It's the Mahabharata of cinema. Like, it's this text that we can't ever get away from.
Yeah. What are your, like, formative films? What are your foundational films?
In a queer sense or just in general?
In general.
I saw Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in its original release. I was 4 years old, and that movie was a childhood obsession, and then I kind of ignored it for a while, and then I revisited it in college and came to appreciate it on a whole other level. Like, I think that's a movie you watch as a kid and you just think, okay, it's a, you know, kind of a, it's a dark kid story. And then you watch as an adult and you're like, no, this is a really dark kid story,
so
in a way that most kids films of the last, you know, 60 or so years would just never do. So that's a film that is probably to this day the movie I've seen the most times. Like, I can pop it on just at any point. If it's showing, if I'm on an airplane and it's one of the options, I will put it on, you know. So that's a big one for me. The first, you know, there were definitely, like, little kind of gay moments along the way. You know, a friend of mine's parents took us to see Polyester when it opened, which, when I was way too young to see it, but that was, you know, a great experience. But, like, I remember the first gay movie that I saw after I had come out and was in a relationship and could sort of recognize aspects of what a gay relationship would look like is the movie Parting Glances, which is a late 80s kind of pre-nuclear cinema movie that I still really love, written and directed by Bill Sherwood. It was the one feature he made before his tragic passing from AIDS-related complications. But I just, like, I'll never forget it. I'm watching it, and there's a scene very early on in the film where it's a couple, and one of them is sort of sitting on a park bench in Central Park reading a book, and the other one is jogging in circles. And they go back to their apartment, and they immediately, like, you know, start getting intimate with each other, and they fall on the bed. And as they're you know, making out, one of them is using his feet to push the other one's shoes off of his feet. And I had done that recently. And it was this first moment of like, oh, okay. Like I'm recognizing a queer thing from my now queer life in a movie. And it was an exciting moment.
That is such a great film.
Yes.
It's like, there are a million great things about it, but then all of a sudden, Mimi from the Jim Carrey Show.
Yeah, and Steve Buscemi.
And Steve Buscemi. Young, beautiful Steve Buscemi.
Yeah,
a classic.
What do you have is there a hill that you'll die on or sort of a boldly unpopular hot take on a movie other than not caring for The Wizard of Oz, which is already forgotten and forgiven?
Thank you, sir. I'll do a positive one. I have always contended that if the legendary Lily Tomlin, John Travolta bomb, moment by moment, were in French, critics would take it more seriously. I think it is a very sort of languorous late 70s, early 80s kind of movie. One critic I know referred to it as white wine cinema. And I think it's doing some really interesting stuff in terms of how it's exploring class differences where, you know, between the sort of richer woman and the working class guy, the fact that they are almost these mirror images of each other, like they have the same hairdo, that kind of thing. And there are moments of it that are patently ridiculous, I will grant you, because like if you name the John Travolta character Strip and then have Lily Tomlin say to him, Strip, Strip, in moments of, you know, dramatic intensity, it doesn't play. But there is something about the film's sort of general languorousness where seriously, I think if they had done it in French or if they had cast like, I don't know, you know, Anouk Aimée and, you know, some young, hot, you know, Thierry Lhermitte or something, you know, whoever the hot French stud of the early 80s was, I think American critics would be like, oh, yes, it's a meaningful, you know, examination of, you know, our societal anomie or whatever.
That's not streaming anywhere, is it?
I don't know if it's streaming. There is finally a Blu-ray. Jeff Nelson at Shout Factory, bless his heart, did get us a Blu-ray a few years back. So people can see it, and you should, because it's a fascinating kind of female gaze, lesbian but not lesbian movie, you know, made between, you know, these longtime partners, you know, Lily Wagner and Jane Wagner, who wrote and directed it. You know, it has this sort of like, you know, the theme song is by Yvonne Elliman. It's all very beige in a way, but it is a fascinating artifact, and I think an underrated movie, even though I will admit there are parts of it that just flat out didn't work.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your thoughts about a slightly less gay movie from around the same time. What is your personal take on Making Love?
I think Making Love deserves a lot of credit. Like it's very easy to slag Making Love as being like the queer Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, in terms of it being this sort of like very safe, you know, exploration of a contemporary hot topic. But to explore that hot topic at all in 1982, I think was, you know, a pretty bold move, even though 1982, there is this sort of mini boomlet of queer movies, whether it's about a response to Cruising, whether it's a response to like the Anita Bryant political stuff for the late 70s. But that year you get Making Love, you get Victor Victoria, you get Personal Best, and you get the terrible Partners. But yeah, I think Making Love is trying to do something and understanding the parameters with which mainstream audiences are or are not ready for the things that it's doing. And I think it's bolder than we give it credit for being. You know, there is two hot actors kiss in that movie, which was career suicide in 1982. And I'm sure both of those actors would probably say, yeah, it was maybe not the thing to do because neither of them quite reach that pinnacle again. They found, you know, success elsewhere. But, you know, I think it's a compassionate film, and I think it is a, it's a good primer, I think, for suburban straight audiences who'd never seen a gay anything before. It's a good place to start.
Yeah. Speaking of, I think that same year, Death Trap, Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve.
Yep, you're right.
I saw that
right
in the theater, and that was like, ooh, people, what's happening?
Were there riots? Did people throw popcorn?
No. Everyone okay. took it. Right. Yeah. I think everyone was having their own personal moment too. I assume. What have you liked in the last year? What are your favorite films of 24 so far?
Well, I mean, I'm going to cheat a little. One from last year that I thought was great that I hope heralds sort of a new way of doing queer films was the comedy Bottoms. I thought that was just genius. And it was, I don't think I've seen a movie since Heathers that made me feel like I was watching the rules of movie comedy being rewritten in front of me, you know? So I thought that was really great. I love that we're having this moment of trans cinema. Like, I think we're kind of in the middle of a new queer cinema for trans filmmakers with like The People's Joker and I Saw the TV Glow. I think those are stories that we haven't been getting, you know, outside of like queer film festivals. And now they're really getting out to a major audience, and they're very uncompromising. I mean, those are both movies that kind of demand that you meet them where they are, and they're not out to like soft pedal and, you know, hold your hand and walk you through it. But I think they're personal, and they are, you know, just exciting filmmaking. And so I really hope that we're getting a lot more of these, that we've reached that moment where trans voices become more and more part of the culture, particularly since I think they're the ones who are the front line right now in terms of, you know, gross right wing people coming after us, you know. And make no mistake that if they manage to get through the line of trans people, they're coming for us next.
Yeah. Something that I have not seen, admittedly, fell asleep to last night, but I've tried to watch only because I've been hearing so much about it as sort of like the first great rom-com in many years, is the Anne Hathaway.
The Idea Amazon, of You.
The Idea of You. Thank you. Have you?
Yeah, it's charming. I think the two of them are very charismatic and know what they're doing. It's what's interesting about The Idea of You is that, I mean, you know, yeah, it is following basically a kind of rom-com, you know, blueprint, but it's a movie about like how shitty fame is and how, you know, even if you're sort of fame adjacent, you're going to get caught up in this sort of like ugly kind of media scrum and social media people coming after you and that kind of thing. And it's the kind of movie that makes celebrity look like the last thing you would ever want to pursue.
Last night, my husband was playing something in the car, and he was trying to make me guess what it was. And I was like, I don't know, but I like it. And it was August Moon, the fictional band from the movie.
The fake songs are not bad.
The fake songs are some bops.
Yeah. And look, I mean, for me, the pinnacle by which all are measured is, you know, the Josie and the Pussycats songs. But I will say the August Moon ones are pretty good.
But this is such a detour. But don't you think there is, especially in the wake of Barbie, I know there was a Gem and the Holograms movie that I don't even consider, you know, canon.
Canonical.
isn't there a potential for a great Gem and the Holograms live action feature with starring a bunch of, you know, current pop girlies?
Oh, for sure. And I'll tell you, I didn't hate the Gem and the Holograms movie, mainly because I'm too old for the original cartoon to have meant anything to me. So like,
fair.
I would have enjoyed a spinoff of just 2 hours of Molly Ringwald and Juliette Lewis getting on each other's nerves. Like, that to me was the reason I was there. And those, some of those fake songs are actually pretty good. I think I have a few in my iTunes still. But yeah, I think, you know, I always say never remake the movies that worked. So if somebody had a new idea for a Gem and the Holograms movie, a live action movie, I don't think anyone's going to hold up the existing one. It's like, what? How dare you tamper with this perfection?
Yeah. Well, although to be fair, I forgot that Molly Ringwald and Juliette Lewis are in it. So I stand corrected.
If we can see the Joker as many fucking times as we've had to see the Joker, we can see Gem twice, right?
Indeed.
Oh, exactly.
There's six goddamn Batman movies a year, and they're all in different universes. Let's just, anyway, sorry.
And introduce the Misfits, you know, before the closing credits this time.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Come on.
that was a mistake.
Yeah. When I was younger, the dream cast was Britney as Jem, Christina as the leader of the Misfits, and Madonna as Synergy. Mm-hmm. Of course, everything has changed. Now we're at a point where Britney can be Synergy. You know, She can pass the baton to, I don't know who would be Jem, not Taylor.
It feels Sabrina Carpenter to me.
Yeah, I don't know who that is, but I bet she's.
Do you not know Espresso?
I don't think so.
Matt McCall. Okay. Show's over. Show's over.
Alonzo, do you know who this is?
I don't, but I'm ancient, so you know.
Okay. No, you're
I know
not.
Victoria Rodrigo.
Olivia. So actually.
Olivia. See, okay. You don't, this, but, that's how bad.
No. Okay. Well, there's a song called Espresso by Sabrina Carpenter, and it is a jam and a half. It's fucking great. I promise you will love it. Both of you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've been spending all my time listening to some podcast where some gay natter's on about MTV. So what do I know?
Okay. Okay. Good, 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 good. Keep doing what you're doing.
Don't worry about Sabrina Carpenter.
That's been our dishwashing soundtrack for weeks.
Oh, good.
Thank you for making the time pass.
Good.
Good choice. Good.
You're welcome. You're welcome. A fine choice. So there's a we. You mentioned a we.
Yes.
Dave White is you're married?
Yeah.
Married. Okay. We
got married like before it was legal anywhere. And we thought it was never going to happen in our lifetime. So we just wanted to like do the thing. So we got married back in 97, but then finally legally in 2008, like right before, you know, California took it away. And so, we were West Hollywood domestic partners and California domestic partners. And we got married in San Francisco during that hot minute when Gavin Newsom was giving out licenses to same-sex mm-hmm. couples. I like to joke that we've been married more times than Elizabeth Taylor, but always to the same person.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet?
We met in 1995 through, and this is a very 1995 story, a personal ad in the Dallas gay paper. He had a friend who was like the hot, like she was the girl who broke the heart of every hot boy in an indie music band in Dallas at the time. And then one day she was like, you know what? I did this thing. I put a personal ad in. And he was like, why? And she goes, I just wanted to see how it was going to go and who I might meet. And it didn't really go anywhere. But then she made him do one in the gay paper. And he very consciously wrote an ad that didn't sound like the usual two, which were either like, you know, Spank Me Daddy or Where's My Prince Charming. And just kind of cataloged a bunch of pop culture things that he liked and was interested in. I seem to recall the mention of ice cream and you should own a dictionary. So yeah, so I called and left a message, and it turns out we had met once years earlier at an ACT UP protest, but we started hanging out and platonically and then not platonically.
Wow. And here we are.
And here we are.
I just want to know about all the dating experiences that came before him.
Before that, I had been living in Los Angeles actually for about 2 years, and it was kind of a mixed bag. There was one person I dated for a while, but I'll tell you, the thing that I was always terrible about as a young person and having, you know, I came out at the end of college, so I did not have the kind of teen high school college dating experiences that today's queer youth do. I would say if I could give advice to myself at that time, would be like, maybe don't sleep with them quite so quickly, you know, maybe get to know them first and then see where that goes. And so I think one of the great things about, you know, finally meeting Dave was that my first impulse was like, we're going to be friends and that's fine. And, you know, and so I did really get to know him and he became my best friend. And then I also then realized he was a catch. And so that kind of broke my streak of doing it wrong.
Well done.
Who were you in high school?
I was on the debate team. And also we had, I'm so like always the person that I am. I wrote film reviews for the student paper. I did film reviews on our closed circuit TV thing. So I've always just been this guy basically waiting to, you know, like for somebody to pay me for it. But yeah, so it was weird because I'm the youngest of seven children. We all went to the same high school, and I'm enough of a like change of life baby that like my oldest siblings are, you know, 12, 13 years older than me.
Oh, wow.
So in high school, I started having as teachers, people who had been classmates of my siblings.
Oh, interesting.
So that was a little wacky. But yeah, I was never cool, but I was probably like, people say that I was raised in the house of sarcasm. So I'm sure I was like unfilteredly, I'm going to say it, I was probably mean. I was probably verbally very cruel. And I retroactively apologize for that.
And which, by the way, could come in very handy as a critic if you wanted to wield that. But I find that you do not, that you really do come at your work with kindness.
I give it my best shot. Some people test that, but I've even read stuff I've written like, you know, in the last 20 years. And I think, oh man, that was, you could have calmed down a little there. I think it is fun to come up with the cutting quip, but I think you have to sort of really save those or else you just become the person that does that all the time.
Yeah. You know, in the 80s, 70s, older siblings were the ultimate sort of cheat code to cultural knowledge.
Right.
What did your siblings turn you on to musically, in the world of cinema?
Musically, like, you know, they were very, I'm a geriatric Gen Xer and they were all mm-hmm. boomers to one extent or other. So I probably had a lot of knowledge of like kind of 60s girl groups and stuff that most people my age maybe didn't have. Cinematically though, again, my oldest brother is 12 years older than I am, went to Harvard in the early 70s. And that became that was sort of a hotbed of a lot of revival of a lot of golden age Hollywood stuff. The Casablanca revival, the Marx Brothers, a lot of that really stemmed out of, you know, Harvard students and you know, programming at the cinema there and that kind of thing. So he comes home with all of these books about golden age Hollywood and, you know, Greta Garbo and MGM and Alfred Hitchcock. And as a 9-year-old, I'm devouring this stuff and like circling, you know, this is pre-cable or VHS. So I'm like combing through TV Guide every week to see like when's Notorious going to be on or whatever. So those books really kind of set me off on, you know, the path of where I am right this second.
And let's hear it for siblings.
Amen.
The book is Hollywood Pride. It is out now. The time that you're hearing this. Alonzo Duraldi, thank you so much for being here.
Y'all, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show. Please do give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Instagram at HomophiliaPod. Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, music by Ben Wise. Our executive producer is Renee Colvert. Our associate producer is Jess Walensky, and our audio engineer is Justin Mattson. Many thanks to Michael Pressman and everyone at World of Wonder.